The Torah begins Parshas Vayera with the discussion of the Anashim, the Malachim, who visited first Avram, then Lot. They were involved in the destruction of Sodom. Basically, the first half of the Parsha involves these three Anashim. What they were is the subject of considerable disputes among the medieval commentators. Basically, when the Torah talks about them in the context of Avram, it says, "Vinei shlosha anashim." There were three men, and the Torah repeatedly refers to them as men. The Torah says that the Torah, "Vayakum misham ha'anashim," later says that it refers to them only as anashim, as men. Later, in the context of Lot, when they went to Sodom, and they had the whole story with Lot putting them up overnight, and the mob, the lynch mob in Sodom, assaulting, besieging Lot's house, there the Torah refers to them sometimes as Anashim and sometimes as Malachim. It says, again, when they finally left Avram, it still refers to them as Anashim, Vayifnu Misham HaAnashim, the men left Avram. Avram had the whole conversation with God, trying to defend Sodom, trying to plead for mercy for Sodom. When they get to Lot, there the Torah goes back and forth. Sometimes it refers to them as Anashim, and sometimes as Malachim. The Torah begins when they first arrive at Lot's house at Sodom. It says, "Vayvo shnei ha-malachim." There are only two of them now, but it refers to two Malachim. Then the Torah goes back and forth, though. It says that the mob, the Sodomite mob, besieged Lot, and they said, "Aye ha-anashim, where are the men?" And then Lot says, "Rakla anashim ha'el," these men don't do anything, don't leave them alone, don't do anything to them. "V'yishlechu ha'anashim es yadam," the men dragged Lot inside, etc. "V'yomer ha'anashim el Lot," the men. Then it goes on and it says, "Kama ha'shachar ala," as day broke, "V'yitzu ha'malachim belot," the malachim pressed Lot, saying, "Let's get out of here, we were out of time." So basically, in the context of Avram, they're referred to two or three times consistently as Anashim. In the context of Lot, not clear what the rhyme or reason is, what the pattern is, but the Torah goes back and forth, referring to them sometimes as Anashim, sometimes as Malachim. Now Hebrew, biblical Hebrew, doesn't really have a dedicated word, as English does, for angel. The word we always use is Malachim. But Malach, we know from basic Hebrew, Malach means a messenger. Malach, the Torah later refers to, they sent Malachim to the kings, they sent envoys, emissaries to the kings to negotiate, diplomatic envoys. So Malach, obviously, in a broad sense, just refers to a messenger. So obviously they weren't just ordinary people. Obviously they were somehow, there was some divine aspect to them. They were somehow on a mission from God, obviously. But what they were is very unclear. And the truth is, the Torah refers to Malachim in a divine, in a theological context, probably dozens of times throughout Tanakh. In Chumash Bereishis itself, we have perhaps six or eight different episodes involving Malachim. We have in Parshas Lech Lecha, it says that when Hagar ran away from the household of Avram, it says she met a Malach, and the Malach told her, "Go back, you're going to have a son, he'll be successful." Refers to a Malach. Parshas Vayera, our story, refers to Malachim. Parshas Vayera actually has a second episode of Malachim. Parshas Vayera later, when Hagar ran away, when Hagar was actually expelled, when she was evicted from Avram's house, it says that she got lost, her Yishmael was dying, and she cried out to Hashem, and it says, she cried, and it says, and Hashem sent a Malach. It says, this time the Torah refers to the Malach specifically as coming min Hashemayim. The Torah says, "V'yikram Malach Elokim al Hagar min Hashemayim," that the Malach, the messenger, called to Hashem min Hashemayim. I remember, I always used to note, visiting the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they have a magnificent 19th century painting of Hagar. It shows this distraught woman on her knees, a look of anguish on her face, and then in the sky you see a bearded guy with a halo on his head and big and angelic wings swooping in. That was the artist's depiction of this Malach. He certainly came min Hashemayim, it says, but again, what that means we'll have to discuss later in the story of Parshas Vayishlach, story of Yaakov. We actually have two or three references to Malachim. First, the Torah says in the end of Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov was returning from exile in Charan, returning to Eretz Canaan, so Parshas Vayetze begins, Avram left Eretz Canaan, it ends with his return to Eretz Canaan. So the Torah says, the Yaakov halach ledarko, v'yifkuva malachei Elokim. Yaakov encountered malachim again of God. And then, beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, we actually... Sorry? He had gone to Haran. Yes. No, I don't think so. Yeah, I think so. The beginning of Parshas Vayishlach, we have two more references to Malachim. The very first pasuk, Parshas Vayishlach, Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lufanav El Esav Achiv. He sent Malachim to Esav. And then, about a couple dozen psukim later, is the famous mysterious story where Yaakov is alone at night and he meets an ish. Again, first, this time the Torah first refers to him as an ish. He meets a mysterious individual, Vayavik Ishimo. He wrestled with a man, Adel Esashachar, until daybreak. And then it says that Yaakov, this ish told him, Kisarisem Elokim, you have battled with Elokim, you have fought with God, so to speak, and you've been victorious. And it says again, Reisi Elokim, I saw God. So again, it starts with a man, it doesn't use the word Malacher, but it refers to, obviously there was something going on here, it wasn't an ordinary person. And so on and so forth. Throughout Tanakh, there are a number of other stories. I'm not going to list all the other ones by name. The story of Shimshon, his parents saw Malach before he was born. Yeshua and Gilgal, beginning of Sefer Yeshua. And again, the question is, in all these anecdotes, in all these episodes in Tanakh, what were these Malachim? Again, it's very hard to know because the Torah's word Malach is very ambiguous. It means messenger. So all these Malachim, who were they? And some of these Malachim, even in Chazal, we find different opinions. So for example, the Malachim that Yaakov sent to Esav, they were envoys. They were apparently also diplomatic envoys. He wanted to treat with him, to negotiate, to try to figure out if they're on the same page or not. So here also we find in Midrashim, we find Tupshatim. Rashi says right away, Malachim Mamish, which seems to mean they were literally angels. Malachim Mamish is kind of a circular definition. They were literally Malachim, and we know that. The question is, what are Malachim? But simply read, Rashi means that they were angels. But there are other Pshatim. Our scroll here, for example, brings that they were humans. They were, you know, they say, angels or human emissaries. And the question that exercised the medievals, the Rishonim particularly, was who were the angels and who were the ones who are clearly divine? This one doesn't seem to have been divine necessarily, but the ones who were just envoys, but the ones that clearly do seem to have been divine manifestations, like the ones who visited Avram and performed miracles in stone, the ones Hagar saw who told her, foretold the future, the one Yaakov had this mysterious wrestling bout with. Who or what were these Malachim exactly? What were they? So we find, broadly speaking, we find three basic opinions in the Rishonim. Chazal, particularly the Rishonim, three basic opinions. There are those who learn that they were angels. They were, you know, non-human, angelic, supernatural beings. They were those who learned that they were humans, that these were humans who were malachim of God. They were emissaries of God. They were prophets, they say. They were divinely inspired, divinely sent, but they were human beings, like, just like you and me. And there are those who learn that the entire narrative, and some of these entire narratives were mere visions. Now, maybe not mere is not the right word. They were prophetic visions, they were nevuah, but nothing actually happened in the physical world. These were simply visions that were seen by the Navi. Actually, the Abarbanel has a kind of barb. He criticizes those who use the word mirror. He says there are other commentators who seem to think that things that aren't in the physical world, that are just prophetic visions, are somehow less real or less significant than actual manifestations of corporeal entities. He says absolutely not. The divine vision is an even loftier thing than a mere flesh and blood messenger. But the word mirror is a loaded word, so we won't use it, but in any event, there are basically three schools of thought.
That's
a good point. I left out that one. In the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, it says that Yaakov went to sleep, and it says explicitly, Vayachalom, he had a dream, and in his dream he saw Malachim. Yes. So there are certain cases in Tanakh like that one, that's a good point, where the Torah explicitly tells us that they were in a dream or in a vision of some sort. But the question is, all the other ones where the Torah does not mention anything about a vision or a dream, where the words of the Torah, taken at face value, taken literally, seem to indicate that these were ordinary manifestations in the real world. So here we have, roughly speaking, three schools of thought. It's actually more complicated than that, because there are certain commentators who explain some of the stories as visions, some of the stories not as visions. We'll discuss this a little bit more as we go. But by way of introduction, these are basically the three approaches that the commentators take to these various narratives of malachim, or of humans who are clearly more than mere humans. So the most famous proponent of the school that these were not angelic beings walking around on 2 feet in the real world is the Rambam. The Rambam didn't write a commentary on the Torah, but he has a great deal of discussion in his Mor Nevuchim and the Guide to the Perplexed, which is directly bears on how to understand Pesukim in the Torah. The Rambam believes very strongly that all references to Malachim in the Torah are actually dreams and visions. Not simple dreams, not like we dream, but prophetic visions, but they're invariably dreams. That's the only explanation for all these narratives in the Torah. And the Rambam's basic philosophical starting point is that Malachim, the Rambam does believe in Malachim, he does believe that there are such things as angels, but he does not believe that these angels can adopt physical form. He does not believe angels are just like God. It's one of the 13 principles of faith. God has no physical form. He's incorporeal. Angels, too, according to the Rambam, are abstract or not incorporeal physical entities. They do not have physical form. The Ramban is going to be of an opinion that, even though normally he agrees to the Rambam that they're not corporeal entities, but they can adopt, he says, if they so desire, if according to the situation, they can adopt physical form. The Rambam rejects that. The Rambam says angels never appear in physical form, never interact with people in physical ways. The only interaction humans we ever have with Malachim is in visions, just as with God. We never see God physically. The only way we interact with him is through Nevuah, through divine inspiration, divine communication of various levels. So too with Malachim, the Rambam's philosophical commitment is to the idea that Malachim work the same way, and that any story of a Malach in the Torah, in Tanakh, is invariably a dream, a prophetic vision. And the Rambam points out, as Phil said, sometimes the Torah explicitly tells you it was a Mara, it was a Chalom, it was something else. Sometimes it doesn't. The Torah is not consistent, he says. The Torah is not always as explicit, as definite about what exactly the prophet was experiencing, but you're supposed to figure it out yourself. You're supposed to know that this is the rule, that it always appears, Malachim only appear as visions, and therefore all narratives in the Torah involving Malachim were visions and were not physical interactions in the waking world.
How can he explain this view? How can he explain the three guests Abraham invited in? He tells Sarah to go shech some.
Excellent.
He serves them.
Yes.
It's a definitely physical thing.
Yes. So that these questions were promptly hurled at the Rambam by the Ramban. Many people are familiar with this Rambam. People who haven't studied the Guide to the Perplexed, many people will have encountered this Rambam through the Ramban's commentary to the Parsha. The Ramban spends a big chunk of the beginning of his commentary on Parshas Vayera sharply criticizing, sharply rejecting the view of the Rambam. The Ramban has many questions on the Rambam. The Abarbanel discusses this issue both in his commentary to the Torah as well. He also wrote a commentary to the Guide to the Perplexed, and he discusses this question of who the Malachim were in both places, but the Abarbanel in his commentary to the Guide actually breaks down the Ramban. He says the Ramban is asking no fewer than 7 questions on the Rambam, and some of the questions that the whole group of the questions the Ramban asks are basically the questions that Phil is mentioning. The Ramban says, first question, it says, if the whole thing was a dream, so he asks Phil's question. He says, Lidvarav, Lolosha, Sarah Ugos, Sarah never baked these cakes or loaves. Loas Avram ben Bakar, Avram never slaughtered an animal. Gam lo tzachka Sarah, Sarah never laughed or expressed cynicism toward the prophecy, toward the good tidings. I call Mara. And if so, he says, Baha Chalamazeh, Barov, Inni Chalamaz HaShaker. This dream is full of bogus, false, inaccurate detail, things that never happened. Ramban can't tolerate that. Mato Elas Laharas lo kolzeh. Even if it was a vision, why would Avram see things that weren't true? What kind of prophecy is that? Then he brings the Rambam, says the same thing, the story of Yaakov's wrestling with the angel, grappling with the angel. Hakol Mar Nevuah. Lo Yadati, one of the most famous kashas of all. He was limping when he woke up. Until today, we Jews do not eat the Gid Anasha because the Gid Anasha is a symbol, is an allusion to the fact that Avraham, that Yaakov had his thigh dislocated. It never happened. It was all a dream. Why was he limping? And what happened to Sdom, he says? Was that a vision? Did Lot share the same vision as Avram? If Lot didn't share the same vision, what did happen to Sdom? Where did Lot end up? What was going on here? The Ramban says. The Ramban also has certain more philosophical, more abstract questions than the Rambam, but these are kind of the more concrete, down to earth questions. What's going on with all the detail in the story? What's going on with all the what actually did happen? What didn't happen? How do we untangle, according to the Rambam, which parts of the story were real? Which parts of the story were not real? So the Ramban, as I mentioned earlier, the Ramban's approach is that while he agrees that in general, in their essence, malachim do not have physical form, they can adopt physical form if they so desire, if necessary, for whatever their angelic goals are, whatever God's goals for them are, they can adopt physical form, and then they interact with people in the normal manner. So, although the Ramban has these powerful questions, nevertheless, the Rambam himself does not really address these questions directly. The Rambam often, partly because he's writing a philosophical work, not a biblical commentary, he does not spend time discussing all the details of the Pesukim. He kind of just grandly makes these statements and leaves you to figure out the details. And figuring out the details is left to the later commentators. In this case, we have lengthy defenses of the Rambam from both the Avraham Barnel, as I mentioned earlier, as well as a couple centuries earlier from the Ritva. The Ritva is best known to students of Torah as the author of commentaries to the Talmud. We think of him as kind of a bread and butter. He didn't really write any major hashkafic work, any major work of parshanut, of exegesis, of philosophy. The one little work we have, which is devoted solely to pshat and chumash, and to studying chumash, to studying Jewish theology, is a very curious, very fascinating little work he wrote called Sefer Azikara, Book of Remembrance. Tiny little work. It's a couple dozen pages, the whole thing. He basically wrote an entire work devoted to defending the Rambam from the Ramban's attacks on him throughout his commentary on the Torah. Now, it's a very, very unusual work. Unlike most works which are written polemically to side with somebody, to defend somebody against somebody else, usually, if you write a work solely devoted to defending somebody against somebody else's attacks, it's because you agree to the person who you're defending. You're his partisan, you side with him, you think he's right. I don't mean ulterior motives, but I mean it's a shita, it's a system you agree with, and you spend time defending it. The Ritva says over and over that in all the disagreements between the Rambam and the Ramban, most of those disagreements are rooted in philosophy and theology and in Kabbalah and mysticism. Most of the disagreements ultimately have to do with the fact that the Rambam had prior commitments to an Aristotelian, a naturalistic, a very kind of scientific and rigorous philosophy, and he therefore had to reinterpret whole swaths of the Torah to fit with his scientific, philosophic worldview. The Ramban is one of the most famous of the early medieval Kabbalists. The Ramban had a much, I don't know, frumer is the right word, a much kind of more traditional Jewish theology, much more internally developed mysticism with internal Jewish traditions. The Ramban takes a much more traditional, much more mystical-friendly approach. And in this ultimate thematic disagreement between the Rambam and the Ramban, the Ritva repeatedly says that he sides with the Ramban. He thinks the Ramban is basically correct. The Rambam was a great man. He has effusive praise for the Rambam, but ultimately he thinks that the Ramban was fundamentally correct in his approach to Judaism, in his approach to the study of the biblical text, in his approach to Jewish philosophy. He thinks that the Ramban was ultimately correct. Nevertheless, he's writing an entire work defending the Rambam because the Rambam was such a great man, the Rambam was such a great scholar, the Rambam did such wonderful things in the development of halacha. And whenever the Rambam was, he was not a fool. He was not a man who made trivial mistakes that we can ask kashas on, that we can just knockingly dismiss what he said. So for the honor of the Rambam, for defense of the Rambam as a great man, he's going to write an entire work, a small work, but an entire work defending him from the Rambam's questions, even though the Rambam is basically right. He's just going to defend the Rambam to show that it's a viable, serious, defensible shita, even though at the end of the day he's not actually correct. And the Ritva goes even further. He has a kind of veiled but, you know, slightly sharp criticism of the Ramban. He says the Ramban, because he was so busy, because he knew that he had the mystical truth, because he had the ultimate in revealed truth beyond philosophy, he says the Ramban simply wasn't interested enough in the Rambam to spend enough time to try to really understand and defend his shitas. The Rambam just—it was wrong. The Rambam was not interested. So sometimes he says he was just busy learning. You know, he had other things to do. So sometimes he just didn't give the Rambam the full attention he should have. He should have. He says, for example, he says Mechila Merabeinu Hagadol, with all due respect to the Rambam, he says Elafi Hanira, apparently, some of his objections to the Rambam, he says the Rambam missed the point. Ki merov haflagaso b'talmud, because of all his hasmada, because of all his focus on single-minded focus on Talmud, and because of all his focus on Chochmas HaEmes, on Jewish mysticism, he says he didn't spend as much time on the Rambam's philosophical works as he might have, and therefore he sometimes misunderstood the Rambam. Someone like me, he says, minor people like me might have sometimes understood the Rambam better than the Ramban. Not because I'm wiser than the Ramban. The Ramban was much greater than me, but the Ramban had better things to do. So the Ramban studied what he thought was the truth, and I'm going to defend the Rambam, not because I'm greater than the Ramban. Ritva was very, very humble throughout this piece. He keeps on referring to himself as a very minor figure compared to the Rambam or the Ramban. Nevertheless, he repeatedly says he doesn't think that the Ramban always was sufficiently fair to the Rambam, so he's going to write an entire work defending the Rambam, even though he thinks the Ramban was basically correct. Rambam was first. Rambam was first in the Maimonides in the 12th century. Ramban was either late 12th or earlier mid 13th. I don't have the exact dates. The Ramban never, half a century later maybe. And the Ritva was a century or two after that. The Ramban actually has a famous letter during the great Maimonidean controversy that erupted repeatedly, but during one of the great controversies that erupted over the Rambam's approach, where the traditionalists were outraged at his importation of philosophy into the Torah, and the Rambam's philosophical errors staunchly defended it. Ramban has a very famous letter where he tries to make peace between the two sides. He has great respect for the traditionalists, but he also has great respect for the Rambam. Again, kind of like the Ritva, he ultimately sides not like the Rambam in most of these things, but he tries to explain to the Rambam's fiercest and most implacable opponents that they really should have more respect for the Rambam. They should appreciate what he's doing, and even if they don't agree, they should not be as dismissive and as negative toward him, because he was a great man. That was Ramban writing to the Rambam's opponents to try to convince them to have more respect for the Rambam.
Okay, so then the criticism
rebounds.
Ramban doesn't hold, because the Ramban was the first paying attention and defending.
He was, but according to the Ritva, he was certainly much more respectful than the others were. But the Ritva says sometimes he also uses very strong language. He says that the Rambam, the Ritva, he says sometimes use words. He says because he was, again, so committed to Kabbalah, so committed to mysticism, an idea which was antithetical to the Rambam, he says, it brought him lekalkel b'musaro, to speak about the Rambam in a disrespectful way, b'loshon gnai, and he says, hevel havalim, and divrei havai. He wasn't sufficiently respectful. So you're right, even though he was much more circumspect and much more respectful than some of the Rambam's more vehement opponents, nevertheless, the Ritva feels that even the Ramban sometimes went a little too far, did not treat the Rambam with enough gravity, with enough seriousness that he deserved. So on our Pasha, on Pasha's Vayera, where the Ritva spends some time defending the Rambam against the Ramban's attacks, so we're not going to go through his discussion of all the Ramban's criticisms, but first dealing with Phil's question, the Lisha, the kneading of all those cakes, and the Ugos, the Ben HaBakar, the animals, Sarah. So what was going on there? Says the Ritva, the Rambam is not concerned about that. You're right, he says. The Ramban is correct. There's lots of detail there which is not really significant, doesn't correspond to anything true, anything in the real world, but it's just thrown in as just general detail to fill out the vision. No problem, he says. According to the Rambam, Rova Nevuos, most Nevuos come in Mishalem. They come in metaphors and allegories. And metaphors tend to have some detail, which are not every aspect of a mashal is always going to have some significance. Some of the details are just thrown in for the mashal. This is not a doctrine which is popular today. Most of the popular hashkafis, Jewish thinkers today, do not accept this doctrine. They believe that when Chazal give a mashal, certainly when the Torah gives a mashal, every single detail is significant. Every single detail has some meaning. Every single detail must be understood. But some of the Rishonim were less convinced. Some of the Rishonim felt that when you design a mashal, when you construct a mashal, there's an underlying truth, there's an underlying theme of the mashal. And some of the details are just thrown in to round out the vision, to make it into a coherent, solid whole, but not every single detail has any particular meaning. When it's describing a vision. For example, there's a famous discussion where another famous rabbi says in Parshas, we say in the Haftarah, we read, I think, on Pesach, it says, one of the most famous passages in all of Tanakh, we say, in the future, where everything will be peaceful and wonderful, it says, "V'garzeiv v'keves, the wolf shall lie with the lamb, v'arye kabaka yochal teven, the lion like the ox shall eat straw." And a child. That's in Navi. That's in the Yeshaya.
Okay, look, this is very getting complicated because one of Rambam's 13 principles is all the words of Torah, if I'm not mistaken, all the words of Torah are truth.
Yeah, so let me discuss that.
You can't say that the stuff in the Torah is a mashal.
Let me address that. So the Rambam has a very famous shita in the Yalach HaZaka and in the letter where he writes, and all that talk about the animals living in harmony and singing kumbaya together does not refer to a real thing. Lions are lions. They eat their predators and they eat their prey and they devour prey, and lions will not. The Rambam gets very sarcastic. He says, you think the lion today is a vile brute, and if we educate him and send him to a re-education camp, he's going to suddenly see the error of his ways and start eating grass? It's ridiculous. He says, lions are lions. Nothing's going to change. Rama said it's a metaphor. It means peaceful coexistence among nations. It means that human beings will develop to a spiritual level where they will no longer be full of strife and full of war and full of murder and stuff like that. So the Rambam says this in the Yad, and the Ravid, who is again more traditional, the Ravid asks, and the Rambam, he says, "V'halokasiv b'Torah v'shbati chaya ram in haaretz." In Parshas B'chukosai, in the Tochacha, God says that if the Jews behave well, that they do what they're supposed to do, I will eliminate all evil beasts, all predatory beasts from the land. So the Ravid says, how can you say that this is all a mashal? So people ask on the Ravid, what's the problem? The Rambam knows there are lots of psukim in Tanakh that describe animals living peacefully. He said it's a metaphor. So why can't that be a metaphor too? So some Akronim understand the Ravid, as you were suggesting, in Nach, where things are more poetic, more literary, other Nevi'im who had Nevuos that were not like Moshe Rabbeinu, which were not as vividly clear and as literal as Moshe, Yeshaya HaNavi could have seen things as a metaphor. Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moshe Rabbeinu was telling the Jews what God said about their future, Moshe's Nevuah, as you said, it's a Yesod in Emunah, it's one of the foundations of faith, and everything he saw, everything he received from God, had to be literal. So they discussed that, is the Rambam really claiming that even some of the Nevuahs of Moshe Rabbeinu are not literal or not? That's a question we don't have time to get into. I didn't prepare this point. But certainly when it comes to the Nevuahs of other Nevi'im, even the ones that are recorded in the Torah, if the Torah describes Avram, or Hagar, or Yaakov, or Bilam, that's another one of the ones we'll discuss maybe soon, Bilam and his donkey, seeing Malachim and communicating with God or angels, there, the Rambam's view is that the Torah is describing Mishalim that they saw, they're describing visions, allegories that they saw in dreams or in prophetic visions. And the Ritva is telling us that not every detail in such a vision has to be literal. Not every detail has to be literal, and not every detail has to correspond to anything in the real world. Some of the details were just there to flesh out the story and make it into a coherent and meaningful story. There is perhaps a more satisfying shot than the Ritva gives. The Abarbanel, in his defense of the Rambam, he has perhaps a somewhat more satisfying explanation for all these details of the cakes and the animals and all that. He says that no, according to the Rambam, it's true those were all visions. It's true none of those things happened in the real world. But there's a point to all of them. They were all aspects of the Nevuah. They all have some meaning. So, for example, the reason the Torah describes Avram's extraordinary chesed, extraordinary graciousness and kindness toward his guests, is A, the Torah wants to tell you that that was Avram's midah. In Hashkafa, in Machshava, we often refer to Avram as chesed. The midah of Avram is chesed. Chesed l'Avram. Where does that come from? Where do we see Avram as a Baal chesed? The one mekar in Torah Shabbat is this week's parsha. Is the parsha of Avram going to extraordinary lengths to please and to be gracious to his guest? So the Rambam kind of turns it on its head. He says, yes, that was Avram's midah, the defenders of the Rambam. That was why, that was one of his great merits. That's why perhaps even he merited having a son. He merited great divine providence, great nisim, because of his tremendous lengths he went to excel in the midah of chesed. These particular events were not things that actually happened. But these particular events were just symbolic. They were just kind of an allegorical representation of what Avram did to show you it wasn't just one episode that happened on one day. This was Avram's whole life. And the Nevuah, he saw this to show that it was because of his extraordinary commitment to chesed, that's why he merited special help from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The story of Lot. So the general pshat of Lot, Sdom, the Ritva, discussed at greater length by the Abar Benel, is that Lot was not a Navi. Lot did not see anything. The entire part of the parasha dealing with Lot and men visiting him and the mob and the attempted rape and the dragging him out and the all that was all part of the vision. None of that happened in the real world. In the real world, what did happen? In the real world, Lot was actually, the stone was actually destroyed. It was destroyed by maybe an earthquake, maybe a tsunami, maybe an I mean, there aren't really an ocean near there, but maybe an asteroid strike. I don't know. That there was something that there was some kind of natural disaster, natural brought about by God. But Sodom was wicked. Sodom is referred to all over Tanakh as being wicked and degenerate. Sodom was wicked. God did wish to eliminate and punish Sodom. God did bring about destruction to Sodom. Lot did somehow escape. Perhaps Hashem motivated him to go out for a camping trip for a couple of days. Whatever it was, Hashem always moves the world, even Bizman Hazeh. We don't see explicit miracles. Hashem does bring things about in such ways that his goal is accomplished. So to an ordinary observer who didn't have the benefit of Avram's prophetic vision, they would have seen some terrible catastrophe befall Sodom, and they would have seen that Lot somehow managed to escape. But Avram was shown this entire picture of men and coming to Lot and taking him out. That was all a message to show Avram that Hashem is bringing about the destruction. When we see events in the world, we don't know what they mean. We see destruction. We don't know why there's destruction. We don't know what happened. This Nevuah was a vision to show Avram the reason what's happening to Sodom is wicked. Sodom needs to be punished. Look at this example of the wickedness. They have mobs to rape strangers coming through town. Lot was saved because he was deserving. He somehow was specifically singled out by God, whether it was his own merit or some other merit, Avram's merit, whatever it was, Lot had some merit for which God saved him. But in the actual world, none of that really happened. It was just some kind of unnamed destruction that befell Sodom, and some kind of influence by God to get Lot out before it was too late. What about Yaakov's dislocated thigh, dislocated hip? What happened there exactly? Why did that all happen if the entire thing never occurred in the physical world? So here we turn to the Ralbag. The Ralbag was a great follower of the Rambam, even more extreme than the Rambam in certain cases. The Ralbag actually diverges from the Rambam in Ar Pasha. In Ar Pasha, where the Rambam says it was a vision, the Ralbag actually learns that they were Nevi'im, they were human Nevi'im. Hagar also, the people who came to Hagar, he says, were human Nevi'im. One of the objections of the other Rishonim to the idea they were Nevi'im, the Ben Ezra already brought such an idea that the people who came to Avram were Nevi'im. The Ben Ezra says, well, there weren't any other Nevi'im. Who else was a Navi besides Avram? Orbach says, no, yes, there were other Nevi'im. He says, Chazal bring up Shabbat that Shem Ve'Ever were Nevi'im. Chazal did single out various people who were around at that time who were tzaddikim and who reached the level of Nevuah. There could have been other Nevi'im. And why exactly did Hashem have to send other Nevi'im to Avram? If he himself was a Navi, that's a question he doesn't fully explain. He does say they were sent to Sarah, not to Avram, because Avram didn't need them, but he doesn't really explain why Hashem couldn't simply send Avram to Sarah. That would have been a little more efficient, it would seem. but not clear. That's really one of the kashas, the other Rishonim ask in this chat. But that's the Ralbag sheet of many of these stories in Tanakh, including the stories of Hagar and of Avram in this week's parasha, were actual human Nevi'im, not actually angels and not a prophetic vision. And he actually brings a pasuk. There's a pasuk in Treyasar. It says, Vayavo Chagai Hanavi Malach Hashem. Chagai is one of the Nevi'im. And it says it calls him a Navi and also calls him Malach Hashem. So as we said earlier, as we began the discussion, Malach is a Hebrew word that clearly is sometimes used in a non-angelic context, where it just means messenger. And particularly the Ralbag says, you see that Chagai Hanavi was called the Malach. And he brings a Medrash Rabbah that says, the Malach who came to Avram was Shem. And in general, you see that a Malach is called a Navi. The Malach is called a Navi. So the Ralbag's approach is that many of these stories of human-like Malachim interacting with other humans were actually Nevi'im, not visions and not angels. However, when it comes to Yaakov, the story of Yaakov, clearly he says that doesn't make sense. Yaakov was not sitting there fighting with another Navi. That's not what happened. So that, he says, was definitely a prophetic vision like the Rambam. So if it was a prophetic vision, then why exactly was he limping when he woke up? Why did this vision, how is this related? How did he hurt his thigh? And how is this related? How is this related to the vision? So here, in a tour de force, the Ralbag has two pshatim for how the injury to his thigh was related to his dream. First of all, the Ralbag says, sometimes when a person dreams about something, the dream affects, this is really said by earlier Rishonim too, by the Ritva already, at the same time as the Ralbag, but the Ralbag develops the idea much more carefully. The Ralbag says, when a person dreams about certain things, he may find that his body is affected by those dreams. So if a person dreams that he is... If a person dreams that he is fighting, for example, he says, so in his sleep, he'll thrash around till his arms, his legs will move around. It possibly says that because Yaakov saw a vision involving fighting, therefore, in his dream, in his dreams, his legs moved and he injured his leg as a consequence of his dream. Or, says the Ralbag, exactly the opposite. We can reverse that 180 degrees. He says the opposite is true, too. He says if a person has a physical experience in his sleep, that may affect what he dreams. He says if a person touches something cold while he's sleeping, in his dream, he says, he may dream that he's traveling through a snowstorm or swimming in cold water. If he touches something hot, he may dream that he's traveling through a desert or in a burning building. So he says, similarly, assuming Yaakov had actually hurt his leg during the day, why did that happen? Maybe because he was schlepping, he says, he was schlepping a rich man's worth of possessions across the river, so you do that long enough, eventually, he says, you may pull something. He says, because Yaakov had injured his leg during the day, in his dream, when he felt a twinge of pain, that manifested itself in the dream as fighting. Now, the Ralbag does take great pains to say this was not simply an ordinary dream. The dream did have a prophetic component. Exactly how he explains it is beyond the scope of this discussion, but he does explain that there was a supernatural prophetic aspect to the vision too. So the Ralbag summarizes, he says, there were, so to speak, three reasons why he saw fighting in his dream. What did this wrestling, what did this relate to? There were three aspects. There was the prophetic aspect. There was the fact that he felt pain because of the schlepping, and that manifested itself in the dream as fighting. Third, he says, he spent his whole day plotting strategy and tactics against Esau. He spent his whole day thinking about combat, about conflict and fighting. So in his dream, he quotes the famous language of Chazal, Ein Marin L'Adam El Meheruhei Libo, a person is shown in dreams whatever he's been thinking about. So he was thinking about conflict all day, thinking about battle, so he dreamt about battle. So the Ralbag says, the fighting in the dream was related to all three things. It was related to physical pain suffered as a result of schlepping. It had a prophetic component to show something to do with his battle, with his association with this Malach, with this angelic dream figure. It also had to do with the physical pain, the thinking about battle, the prophetic components, and the Gid Anush is related in one of these two directions. Either the physical pain he suffered was as a consequence of the vision, or vice versa. The dream was a consequence of physical pain he had suffered. In any event, we, the Jews, are commanded in the mitzvah of Gidon Asha to commemorate this important prophetic dream, even though the Gidon Asha part might have been a more mundane aspect of it, but it was connected to the dream, and the dream was prophetic, and that is why we have the mitzvah of Gidon Asha. That's how he explains the story of Yaakov and the angel. Turning for a moment to Bilam and the donkey. Bilam and the donkey was also a narrative that exercised the minds of many medieval thinkers, not just for the reason we've been discussing, that many of the medievals did not accept that angels can interact with ordinary mortals in the physical world, certainly not with donkeys. They had an additional problem with the idea of the talking donkey. The donkey talked. Many Rishonim, for some reason, had a very hard time with that idea, even though it was clearly a miracle, even though it was clearly a divine intervention. Chazal goes so far as to say it was one of the 10 things that was created, Ben Hashmasha, a special creation, special nays prepared in advance by God. Nevertheless, many venerable Rishonim, going back to the Gaonic period already, even before the Rishonim, the Ben Ezra brings that many, many early authorities had a very hard time accepting that the donkey could talk. Some of them raised the objection that Nisim are only performed where necessary to save Jews from danger. But what was the point of this nace? You know, Hashem wanted Bilam not to say, not Hashem wanted to stop Bilam, let him stop Bilam. You know, why on earth would Hashem suddenly make this wonderful, incredible nace of a talking donkey? So the Rishonim have different approaches. Some of them say there was a Malach talking. It wasn't really the donkey talking. Then the question is, do Malachim talk? Do Malachim really interact with humans in the physical world? So the Ralbag, again, learns that the entire story was a vision. The entire story of Bilam and the donkey was a vision. And he has actually a remarkably ingenious reading of the Pesukim. If you look at the Pesukim carefully, this is like one of these things you sometimes read about in books that play little games on you. I don't mean to say the Torah is playing games, but if you read the Torah according to the Ralbag, it says that when Bilam was still home, was still home in bed asleep, Bilam had a vision where God came to him and said, "Don't go." Then it says, Hashem said, "If you want to go, go, but you're going to have to do what I tell you to do." Then the Torah says, "Vayakam Bilam Baboker." Bilam arose in the morning, he saddled his donkey, he went with Moav. Then the Torah has a couple dozen psukim, the interaction with the Malach, the donkey, the talking donkey, and so on and so forth. After the entire story with the donkey is concluded, the Malach warns him again, "You're not going to get away with it, you can only do what I tell you to do." It says again, "Vayelach Bilam, sorry, Balak." Says the Ralbag, this entire passage was a dream. From the first time where it says, "Vayakum, Vayelachim, sorry, Moav," he never actually got up here. This was part of his dream. In his dream, he dreamed that the conversation with God was over. He dreamed that it was morning, that he woke up in the morning, that he began to travel. All in his dream, he was on the road. He had the strange behavior of the donkey, the Malach appearing, the conversation, the talking donkey, all part of the dream. Then when the Torah says again, "Vayelach Bilam, sorry, Malach," this was actually where Bilam woke up. He doesn't say "Vayakum" in the morning this time. The Ralbag says this is where he finally woke up. Everything until now was all part of the dream. Again, when we say dream, we don't mean just a random dream full of nonsense. We mean a prophetic dream, a dream sent by God with Malachim. But the actual details, the actual events did not occur in the real world. The donkey never spoke. The Malach never appeared. This was all an elaborate prophetic communication to Bilam. And the actual narrative in the real world resumes when the Torah says, "Vayelach Bilam, I'm sorry, Balaam." Returning to the narrative of Vayishlach, so as we mentioned, Vayetze and Vayishlach, the Torah has several different narratives of Malachim. And again, the Varbanel, the Rishonim who are defending the Rambam, do some very fancy footwork to try to show you what's real and what's not. What was dreams, what was real. So Parshas Vayishlach, for example, as we noted earlier, Parshas Vayetze ends that Vayifku bo Malachei Elokim. Yaakov encountered Malach. Then there's the whole story of the envoys to Esav, and then Yaakov's battle with the wrestling bat with the Ish. So the Rabbanel says all the stuff with Esav was real. Real in the sense of the physical world. The wrestling bat with the Ish, that was prophetic vision. And that was what the Torah referred to when it said, "Yaakov encountered Malachim." For some reason, the Torah waits to give you the details of that until after the story of Esav, and then it describes, how did he encounter Elohim? He met a man, and he wrestled with him in a dream until the morning. And returning finally to Parshas Vayera, that's how the Rambam introduces, again, the Rambam does not give much detail. He doesn't explain pasuk by pasuk. But the one fascinating thing he does say, that's how he explains the opening psukim. The Torah says, "Vayere lof Hashem beilone mamre," God appeared to Avram. "Vayiseinu vayar v'nei shlosha anashim," Avram lifted up his eyes, he saw three men, and he has the whole Hachnasas Archim episode with the men. So the simple reading of the psukim, most Rishonim understand, first Hashem came to Avram, then he had this encounter with the three men. The problem with that is, the Ariel of Hashem, and what happened? What did Hashem say? Where? What? Who? Some learn the Ariel of Hashem refers to the conversation later. The conversation with where Hashem begged for mercy from stone. They begged for mercy for stone. And the reason the Torah puts it out of order is because there was a connection to the narrative of the Anashim, that it was the encounter with the discussion with God occurred after the discussion of the Anashim. It mentions earlier because they were heading off to destroy stone. These Nevi'im, the Ralbag learns, were heading off to destroy stone. And that's when Hashem had the conversation. But the Ariel of Hashem is going on later. Rashi brings a famous idea of Chazal. Hashem was going to talk to Avram, and Avram actually cut off Hashem, so to speak. Avram told Hashem, "I would like to talk to you, but I have a great mitzvah of Hachnasas Archim to do now." And that's what Chazal famously said. Hachnasas Archim is so great that it's greater than talking to Hashem. It's greater than Kabbalah's Pnei Hashchina. Those are other pshat. The Rambam's pshat is, Vayere Lof Hashem, Hashem appeared to Avram. That's the general description of what happened. That's what he calls the klal. What was the prat? How exactly did Hashem appear? In what form? In what context? What happened was, Vayisein Avayar, the entire thing is a description of how Hashem appeared to Avram. How did Hashem appear to Avram? He sent him an elaborate, detailed vision of three men, with Hachnasas Archim, with Nesura for Sarah, with Sodom. All that was a fleshing out of what we say originally of God appearing to him. God appeared to him in the form of these three Anashim and the entire vision that the Torah takes great pains to describe. I'll just close by noting that, as I mentioned several times earlier, the Ritva himself does not really like this shot so much. Ultimately, he does not think it is the ultimate truth. He thinks that the Ramban, with his more traditional account, is actually correct. The Ritva says, in this general question of Malachim, I want to emphasize, he says, I'm going out of my way here to defend an opinion that I do not hold of, Mamashkin Afshoy Amai Delosphirily, because really, he says, the Ramban's approach is Derek Mekubelos of Slula, the Ramban's approach is really correct. Ain Lintas Many Aminu Small, you should stick to the Ramban and not go for these other approaches. Ach, he says, Chamalti Alamarazal, I felt bad, I had compassion for the Rambam. Bel Yasso, his great effort that he did to develop a rationalistic system of thought, of biblical exegesis. Kol Dvarav L'Shem Shemayim, everything he did was for the sake of heaven. V'chachma Gedola, great wisdom was involved. Shein B, said L'Chayoti B'la Handizbem. Someone, a puny figure like me, I shouldn't dare criticize and carp against the Rambam. Kasher Osim Rabbim. Again, he's very upset that many from zealous people have put down the Rambam as criticized the Rambam for being wrong. He says, Im Rabbeinu Zal Noel Adab, Rolatsky Ritzano. Rabbeinu, the Ramban. Ramban was a great man. He says, the Ramban had the right to criticize. Even the Ramban, he criticized earlier for going a little too far. The Ramban, he says, the Ramban wants to criticize the Rambam for going too far. Fine, his prerogative. Lasher Acharav Avon Vash, but for those after the Ramban to dare to mock or to belittle the Rambam, that is completely inappropriate, and that's why he goes to these great lengths to defend the Rambam, even though he does not actually accept it. Regarding the limping, the Ritva says, we mentioned earlier the Ralbag's approaches. Ritva also anticipates this, although not as great length. He says, it's really a very powerful kasha. It really is a difficult question to explain how the limping can be related to an episode that occurred only in a vision. According to the Rambam, he says, we'll have to defend. He says, the nevuah comes somehow through the imaginative faculty. The human psyche has some influence on the nevuah. And he says that when a person dreams or visualizes these things, somehow, he doesn't fully understand how, apparently somehow, it can have some effect on his physical well-being. And he,
it's true. we can all have it. You ever wake up and your heart is beating real fast?
Right, exactly.
Because you're having a dream, you're being right. Like
right.
That's very true.
And then the Ritva says something very strange. He brings that, he said, the non-Jews, they tell a story of a certain Navi who was riding on a camel, and then he had a prophecy, and he felt very heavy, his body felt physically weary or weak. So the notes in the Sefer Zikaron, they say that in Islamic imagery, a man riding on a camel, a prophet riding on a camel, is a symbol or a reference to Muhammad. Ritva himself kind of indicates as much. He says, even though I don't believe this stuff, he says, I don't believe these stories they tell. I don't believe this particular person was a Navi. He says, but nevertheless, the basic idea that what a person sees in a vision can have physical effects is, he says, a correct or a defensible doctrine, and that is pshat in the Rambam.